I'm Mike McGinnis.
And I'm Jeff Prescott.
And this is No Quarter, the one-time weekly arcade podcast, not so weekly these days. How are you, Jeff?
I'm great, Mike. How are you doing?
Oh, just waiting for the snow to stop falling, but other than that, doing okay.
Yeah.
How are things in Virginia?
Snowy as well. And then suddenly not, and very hot and sunny. Yeah, it's like summertime tomorrow, and then it's winter Monday. I don't know.
You were telling me before we started recording that you actually got to work on Dig Dug today. How did that go?
I had a lot of fun working in the garage. I decided to take advantage of the really pretty weather today and spend a little time in the garage. My wife wanted me out of the house. I was getting cabin fever from being buried in 16 inches of snow.
Sure.
So I tore apart the GO7 monitor and the power supply and started desoldering capacitors and rewiring the plates and stuff and put a new bridge rectifier in that bad boy. And I don't even know if the board in my game works. I've never had power on it before. I bought it as a project about a year ago. So I started digging into it and dug. And I don't know, I spent like 3 hours out there and got everything back together. And here's the sad story. I could have maybe applied power to the game and after I got all the wiring done, but I was lacking the fuses from the power supply. And I have a ton of fuses. And apparently the Atari power supply in Dig Dug has a 7-amp fuse that's like the mains fuse, which I have and installed. And then it needs four amp slow blows and a 20 amp. The 20 amp's a little peculiar, and I don't have one of those, but I don't have any of the fours either. So I was at a complete standstill at about 3 o'clock. I have, you know, twos, two and a halves, threes, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 11, but no fours. It was anticlimactic.
Well, that's a bummer.
Yeah, a little. So maybe on the way home from work tomorrow, I'll acquire some 4-amp slow blow fuses and cross my fingers and not start a fire.
Sure, sure. Well, good luck with that. Definitely keep us updated on how that goes.
Sure, man. Sure. What have you been up to?
Well, let's see. Trying to recover a couple of our episodes, and I don't think that's going to happen.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, so back in November, back when we were actually doing No Vector in November, we recorded an episode on Star Trek, the space simulator one, and we had a guest on, and that was my audio and his were recorded on a hard drive that went corrupt shortly thereafter.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and the episode we did after that suffered the same problem. So I don't think those are ever going to see the light of day, at least not in that form. We might be able to get our guests back on and redo it, but
yeah, we could chat with Dayton again, I guess, and
sure,
rehash it.
Yeah, that'd be a good thing. He was nice, and we're talking about Dayton Ward, Star Trek, New York Times bestselling author Dayton Ward, who happens to have one of these Star Trek stand-up games, and he came on and talked to us, and it was a lot of fun. So hopefully we'll have something for you, and in the meantime, that's kind of where we've been, and I apologize for the huge gap in recording and releasing and things like that, but I think we're through the holidays and we're back now. So let's on with the show. What are we talking about today, Jeff?
Well, we're going to make up for our beleaguered listeners and inundate them with some space tool goodness, including a conversation with Owen Rubin, the man himself who did the majority of the programming for that game.
Yeah, I myself have not actually heard this interview yet, but I can't wait.
It's scintillating.
All right, so Space Duel, obviously by Atari. It's a vector game. We'll go ahead and wrap up our long No Vector with this one here in February. That's when the show will be released.
Put a fork in No Vector, huh?
Yeah. It's by Atari, released in 1982, described as a descendant of the original asteroids. And the asteroids are replaced with colorful geometric shapes like cubes, diamonds, spinning pinwheels. Apparently, Space Duel is the first and only multiplayer vector game by Atari, and it's Space Duel was released as a replacement for Asteroids Deluxe. Am I right on that?
A successor to Asteroids Deluxe. Mr. Dave Shepard was working on Asteroids Deluxe, and it had moderate success. But there was a lot of backlash from players about that game being way too hard and very punishing to the player, with the death snowflake apparatus. And, you know, like the lurkers and Asteroids who exploited it for hours, and, you know, like Asteroids Deluxe was kind of, let's take this to 11 and destroy people and make it impossibly hard to do that and randomize things. Space Duel was conceived as a successor in the lineage of Asteroids games, but with better balance and cooperative gameplay, which apparently Mr. Owen Rubin believed in heavily. It was his concept to introduce like the two-player multiplayer aspect of the game.
Okay. The game itself has five buttons. You can rotate the ship left and right, one to shoot, one to activate thrust, and one for the force field, which for me is like the death knell for me being any good at the game at all. It's that thrust management thing. And this game to me felt 100 times harder than Asteroids. I can't imagine how Asteroids Deluxe would have been.
Yeah, Asteroids Deluxe is, I think, harder for me than either one of these games, just because of the little Death Star in there, and how things actively seek you out. They made the difficulty just punishing. Space Duel, Owen enlightened us a little bit in his conversation about there's some randomness with the way that enemies approach you. But in the calculations and the math, things aren't exactly targeting you all the time. Wherein, like Asteroids Deluxe, the snowflake will break up and the little triangles will start seeking you immediately. Almost like like some sort of bacteria in a petri dish. Like they'll just start growing all over you and attacking you. But Space Duel is a little more subtle. And they worked hard to try to balance that out to give some semblance of autonomy back to the player. Like the game wasn't just designed to just scarf your quarter and take off, but to be better balanced and a little more engaging. And it was mildly successful. And the co-op gameplay, I guess we'll have to talk about a little bit, was kind of the counterpoint to Asteroids Deluxe. Like, let's try and get two quarters up front. Were you able to play the game at all, like in the two-player simultaneous mode?
No, I was not. I tend to have no one to play these games with, so it's just me and Mame on the computer usually.
Right on. Yeah, I play with my daughter a little bit. My wife thinks the game is loud and obnoxious, and it is, and it turns her off. But the kid likes it, particularly the bonus rounds where, like, the large crescendo noise pumping out of all four speakers starts to kind of reverberate throughout our entire garage. It's pretty neat. It's loud and colorful.
All right. And so this featured a 6502, the Mod 6502 CPU. The sound were two Atari Pokechips, and of course it's the color vector monitor. It was designed by Rick Maurer, Owen Rubin, of course, Steve Caffey, and Dave Shepard.
Yeah, Rick apparently was the first man on the project, and Owen alluded to inheriting Rick's work. Apparently Mr. Maurer had some sort of nervous breakdown and basically packed up and left his desk one day, and it fell in Owen's lap to finish.
Well, I think he did a fine job at making a game that is very difficult for me.
Yeah, he did. True. It's not easy, that's for sure. I think it's best played with two people, though. I don't like the tethering. I like playing like the spaceship mode, I guess, where the two ships are actually tethered together and like your gravity and inertia affect the other player and you're like chained together like a couple of convicts or something. And as the other player that's chained to you takes damage, they can eventually blow up and that will poison your ship and you will eventually be destroyed because of the damage they take. There's a lot of weird mechanics in play there. I like playing more like the cutthroat two-player simultaneous separate ships, just and a points grabbing kind of scenario. And there you can't, you can shoot each other and destroy each other, but you don't lose lives. Like if I shot you in a two player simultaneous game, I'd get like 500 points for your ship being destroyed. But you would reappear, if you weren't very, very close to, like the next level. If there's, you know, one or two other objects left on the screen, I think there's a threshold where it'll pause and you won't re-enter the screen until like the next level begins. Or at a bonus round, you can be shot right before it starts and cheated out of accumulating points in the bonus round, which is kind of a good strategy to engineer to screw over your opponent. But as a reward, when you get hit, your shield, the length of time that you have a shield, is regenerated to max. So there's actually a reward to getting shot. And if you play cooperatively, the two players trying to push and press as far into the game as they can get, if they shoot each other, you know, periodically to refresh those shields, then you kind of have infinite shields. And there's an exploit in the game that Owen explains that I'll let him explain it, where you can actually get the shield timing up to about 255 seconds.
And oh, wow.
Then you're pretty much invincible, but it's only good per level. It doesn't carry over. But there's no timing in a level. So, I mean, you could get down to like one object and just fly around with the shield on to entertain yourself. But you can repeat the trick over and over and over. And I guess really good players are highly adept at doing that.
It sounds like your assessment about the dual player is right. It really adds a lot to the game, and it takes it from being just an amped up asteroids that's a lot harder into something different entirely.
Absolutely. I mean, the game is essentially Asteroids. The controls are the same. The buttons are in the same place, only we get a shield instead of the obnoxious hyperspace. And you just have different colored shapes. They're not asteroids. They're, I think the bestiary is spinners, octahedrons, cubes, pentagons, books, eight-pointed stars, hexagons, five-pointed stars, and fuzzballs and mines and enemy saucers. So it's this hodgepodge of fun vector shapes in eight colors that is basically Asteroids 3.0 until you introduce multiplayer, and then it really kind of shines. It takes on a whole new character, pun intended.
And these objects appear across 18 different waves in total. I never made it out of the first wave, so...
You never made that first wave?
No, I'm terrible at this game.
Oh, wow.
I like it. I like it a lot more than I enjoyed... Well, I enjoyed my experience with this more than I did with Asteroids, but I'm worse at this. But for whatever reason, I feel the need to go back and continue to play this and get better at it, whereas I didn't with Asteroids.
Yeah, I mean, co-op it, and if you can, and watch it kind of ease into your psyche. Like, you'll start to really like it a lot better. I admit, it's totally boring as a one-player, you know, single ship effort. It's not all that special. But it really shines with two people, especially if you like, you know, the cutthroat aspect. Like, it's like Joust is the same way. I get kind of bored and find it to be kind of an average ho-hummy kind of game until I'm, you know, pitching and shooting and trying to stab the eyes out of my partner. Like, it takes it to a whole other plane.
The game was released in February of 1982. There were 11,017 uprights built, plus another 1,019 cocktails. And since I just mentioned the cabinets, is there anything special about these cabinets, Jeff?
Owen said that the cocktail itself weighs close to 500 pounds.
Whoa.
And I know the upright is pretty heavy. I have an upright, and it's unwieldy, but it's not 500-pound heavy. And Owen kind of was like, well, yeah, dummy, think about the engineering here, when I was talking to him. He alluded to the fact that, you know, Atari engineering has to conceptualize the environment these things will be in. So they assume that people are going to attempt to stand on it or sit on it or kick it over or make off and steal it, you know. So apparently it was oversized and filled with lead bricks. It's just a 6100. you know, a single AR and the game board and the power supply. But for whatever reason, I guess there's, like, you know, some sort of added lead weight or something inside that thing. And Owen's like, yeah, we used to stand on them and jump up and down on them. I don't remember an Asteroids or a Centipede cocktail or anything being that obnoxious. These things are over-engineered, and they are, they're a lot like the Tempest cocktail. They're fatter and wider and almost square-shaped instead of like a more svelte kind of rectangular shape. And it is two-player, sitting across from one another. Owen said he has the cocktail, the original prototype cocktail, is in his possession.
Nice.
And I guess those things were over-engineered, but there are precious few of the cocktail. So that would be highly collectible, I would imagine. And a lot of space tools, unfortunately, are harvested for the Wells Gardner 6100 monitor, the color vector, which is so important to a game like Tempest, where the uninitiated or uninspired people who can't fix their monitor rob one from a space tool and pop it in there to, you know, keep a more popular and well-known game up and running. So space tools, I think, are shrinking, unfortunately.
All right. Well, we're moving right along here because, as you can see, if you downloaded the episode, it's over 2 hours or so. So we want to get you to the interview, the good part. So we'll go ahead and wrap up here. How did you do?
You know, I played on and off so often, and I just kind of took an average score of, I had some good games, some bad games, and then it's been so long, I lost papers and had to redo it. I played today while I was polishing off a beer or two on Dig Dug, and I put up 86,400.
Oh, jeez.
Is that good?
It's a lot better than I did.
Okay. And that's level 19. Like, I guess level 1, like, flipping it. Because those are, like, 18 levels, and then it repeats.
Right,
yeah. So, I guess that's level 1 times 2.
Okay. Well, my score was a pitiful 9,380 points.
Did you ever see the weird little saucers that are later... I don't think they come out on the first board. But on, I think, starting on the second or third, and then every board thereafter. And Owen called them the jugglers, and he created them and programmed them, and more on that in the interview. But they are an absolute scourge. There's two tiny little saucers that fly, like, from either the right or the left-hand side of the screen, and they just traverse, like, the X-axis, right? And they shoot a little ball between them. It's like they fire between each other. They don't kill each other, but there's like this narrow little death zone between them where they're shooting constantly at each other as they traverse the x-axis of space tool. And if you don't cap them, they'll come back and make another pass from the opposite direction that they left the screen, and they'll be a little further apart, and the little shots will travel a little farther, and you know, it'll go from a centimeter to an inch to 4 inches to the whole screen before you realize it. And it's really important to maintain your shield, because they move faster. And if you don't shoot them and break up the pair, they'll continue to shoot back and forth at each other, and they'll basically just create this zone of death.
Wow.
There's a lot of depth here. If you play it some more, I promise you'll like it.
Okay.
But he calls them the jugglers, which kind of threw me. It's he came up with the term fuzzball, I guess, for the weird, hazy looking, circular things that are basically just like giant asterisks. but he was interested when I was reading off the enemy list or whatever from the Atari literature, because he's like, I have no idea who comes up with this stuff. Owen named the book the fuzzball, and he called this what Atari engineering, I guess, calls the saucers. Like, they just call them jugglers in the lab. And it does look like they juggle. It looks like they passed, like, two of those bullets back and forth. It's kind of neat. Now, how this game ended up on a cover of the Who album, It's Hard, I didn't ask, and I thought it would be beyond the scope. the conversation. And I'm sure it's marketing, and weren't they on Warner's record label at that point? So it was probably just a little synergy and Warner throwing their weight around. I didn't get the impression that Owen would know much about that or even be aware of it. So it didn't come up. So that still kind of remains a mystery.
Interesting. All right. Well, do we have anything that we want to add before we move on to the interview?
No, I'm good. Like we kind of discussed earlier before we got going, I'd hate to rehash stuff and go stale. You know, like you can only say so much about it, and it's better to let the man who wrote it speak on it more than it is me.
Okay. Well, before we sign off here, then, here's the sound for next week's game. Okay, and thank you everyone for sticking around through the break, and we'll get back on schedule here doing a regular weekly, or as regular as we can, weekly releases, and here's the interview. Enjoy.
Yeah, I'm gonna go call Al Elkhorn and get a ride in his Tesla.
Okay, let us know how that goes.
Yeah, sure.
Here's a really great new game from Atari. Space Duel, a video game that's so realistic, players will thrill to the experience of a battle beyond the stars. What does all this add up to? When you think of video games, you think of Atari. And when you think of a new space game with unequal challenge and excitement, you think of Atari Space Duel.
So, do you want me to start? I just started and tell you some things about it.
Shoot, go ahead.
So, I don't remember its original name. I can tell you Space Duel was a name that the guy who was in charge of engineering at the time, Steve Calfee, loved the name Space Duel. And I think he used it on a different game, and the game never went anywhere. And then when this game started, it got renamed to Space Duel. I don't know what it was called. It started with another programmer, a guy named Rick Maurer, who was actually worked for the consumer group of Atari, and he wanted to try to do a coin-op game. So they brought him down into the coin-op group, and he started an Asteroids game, and then it was going to be a colored Asteroids game. And he didn't get too far with it. And I don't know if he just lost it, or he just had a nervous breakdown, or whatever it was. Maybe our way of working in the coin-op space was just too hard for him in comparison. I don't know. And he walked away from it. So Steve gave it to me.
Okay, so at its inception, it was planned to be an Asteroids sequel?
A two-player Asteroids game.
Okay.
So he had done the initial work on the tethering. So you could either play tethered or separated, but it was going to be, you know, colored rotating asteroids, you know, using the color hardware. And it was supposed to be the first game to get the color hardware. So
yeah, so this preceded like Tempest and all in development and everything?
And its start.
Okay.
When it started, yeah. So I basically took it over and started working on it, just moving it forward. So, you know, adding things like the bonus wave would put up the wall around the outside, and I reworked a whole bunch of the software on the tethering so it felt more like, you know, you were dragging a stone around so that the gravity seemed to work. All done without math, all done with large lookup tables.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was, you know, 750 kilohertz 6502. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a little 8-bit processor. You weren't going to do a lot of math. That, you know, when they did Battlezone, they added a bit slice computer that talked to the memory map. It did all the 3D math for him.
Right, like, and that's the math box, I assume?
The math box, yeah. Okay. So we didn't have something like that for this game. So, you know, I just made big sine and cosine tables and then knew how what the algorithms were and simplified them down to be able to look them up in tables. So it moved forward a little bit, and then another engineer was doing Asteroids Deluxe at the time.
Is that Dave Shepard?
That was Dave Shepard.
Okay.
So his game moved a little faster forward than mine because I took somebody else's code over and I had to come to the speed on it. And they said, oh, we're going to release Asteroids Deluxe, which was basically Asteroids with that big flower in it, right?
Yeah, the snowflake or the Death Star or whatever, yeah.
The Death Flake, I like that.
Death Flake, all right. Death Flake.
And so they said to me, well, luckily our second Asteroids game, this can't be an Asteroids, do something else with it. So that's when I redid all the graphics into these 3D spinning objects.
Right, I looked that up in the manual, and did you have any input, I guess, on the naming of these amorphous shapes? Because I have...
Wait, they have names?
Yeah, according to the Atari literature, there are spinners, octahedrons, cubes, pentagons, the book, a 8-pointed star, hexagon, 5-pointed star, fuzzball, mines, and saucers.
So the saucers were already there. Fuzzballs was mine.
Okay.
The stars are mine. The book name was mine because that's what I said it looked like, the spinning book. And Pentagon, those things were just names, right? You know, and that wasn't anything clever.
Yeah, that's just geometry, right?
I didn't know they all had official name.
Yeah.
There was the nuclear star, too. I'm surprised that one's not listed.
What's the nuclear star?
The very, very last shape you can get to looks like it has a nuclear warning symbol glowing in the middle of it.
Oh, neat. Okay.
Right. So I thought that was called the nuclear star, but that one never seemed to get in there. That name's not listed. What was the very last one?
The very last one was the 5-pointed star, the fuzzball, and just the mines, which appear early.
So again, this was perceived originally as a Asteroids game. So Steve Calvi and I argued a lot about the mines. I didn't want him in there. But because of the way people lingered in Asteroids to be able to play it too long. So,
right, the lurking strategy.
Taking a left turn and digressing slightly, the ideal video game, coin-op video game, lasted 90 seconds for a quarter.
Oh, so this is like the actual concept of Atari moving forward is 25 cents for a minute and a half your time.
Yeah.
That's the balance.
Okay. That was what everybody said. That should be the average game time.
Okay, so engineering was like, that's the mandate. Make it that hard and
proceed. We didn't go out of our way to try to tune to 90 seconds. But you know what happened with Asteroids? People learned they could lurk on the edge of the screen and play forever.
I've heard that's possible, but I've never been one to actually succeed with that strategy.
Well, so the way it works is the flying saucers get in, same in my game, they get more and more accurate as the game goes on. So the game becomes more and more aggressive. So basically the flying saucer can target you, then there's some randomness added. So it has a chance of hitting you, but if you change your trajectory or you move, it'll miss. But if you're just lurking on the screen, it'll eventually, and you haven't, and a couple things set it off. How long have you been playing total? When was the last time you shot an object? Right. So if there's you're just leaving an objects floating around, it will get more angry. Or how many objects are left on the screen?
Okay. So there's a complex logic here that would reward a player that's actively attempting to clear a level as opposed to someone just along. Floating and taking up space.
If you move along, it works much better, right?
Right.
But if you stall, then it doesn't work as well at all. Right.
As part of the calculation for how the shots are the telemetry of the shot, I guess, like, is the thrust of the player part of the factor in how the bullet shoots?
Oh, yeah.
Like it, so it will predict your path and...
Oh, yeah. In fact, you'll notice sometimes the flying saucer will come out and just kind of lob a shot out.
Okay.
Just kind of lay it out next to it so it moves very slowly, right? Because it's calculating where you're going to be.
All right. So... All right, so that's a long-standing suspicion I've had.
Oh, yeah.
Because it sure seems like sometimes it'll put one up your tailpipe, and it does.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
If you keep going, it'll drop, and you know, you're coming around the screen, it'll drop one on the screen, so when you come around the screen, you hit it.
Oh, even the wraparound. Okay.
Yeah, so we tried to calculate that. So here's what happened in Asteroids.
You guys did fabulously well.
So in Asteroids, there was no wraparound. So what happened is it would try to shoot directly at you. So you basically look at your speed and your position, and you know, so calculate a vector of where you're going, and this that you take a vector from the time the shot's going to come out and the speed of the shot, and you draw it so it intersects the line at where you think it's going to be. Then you add plus or minus a random angle to make it miss.
Okay.
So as that random angle gets lower and lower, it gets more and more accurate.
Okay, right. Like a narrowing degree of accuracy. Okay.
Exactly. So in asteroids, what people do is they'd hang on the edge, on one edge, and then this flying saucer would come out, and they would switch to the opposite edge, so the saucer had to shoot a long shot. So they had lots of time to get out of the way.
Right, and just turn around and fire off the edge of the screen and try and hit it on the wraparound.
As it got closer to you, you went off the other side.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So, so you'd flip around and go off the other side, and then it would start shooting the other direction at the long... So that made people be able to lurk forever. So we tried to solve that somewhat in calculating the wraparound, but it was still difficult. Okay? Mm-hmm. There's a difficulty in calculating the wraparound. So Steve Calfee came up with this idea of putting these floating mines in. And what they do is they slowly target you.
Okay.
So they just move at a real slow rate, unless you bump them, in which case they go faster.
Yeah, they do kind of languidly kind of drift across the screen until they're shot. Which
means you don't really pay attention to them.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Right. But they are targeting you. And as the game goes on, there's more of them and they target more accurately.
And they serve the same function that the Death Flake and Deluxe does, right? Like, because if that shot, it splits and then those pieces like actively seek you out.
No, these are always there. They just appear.
Okay.
And if you shoot them, I forget, one of the concessions I got is that you can shoot them 8 times, I think. Each time you shoot them, they change color.
Yeah, until they turn white and then you can hit them again.
Shoot them when they're white, they will disappear, and they don't really go away. They just get thrown to the edge.
Okay, so they're like off screen, and then eventually they kind of drift back into the playfield.
Yep, they get set back to blue, their beginning color, and they go off the screen.
Is there a randomness to how they enter on the left or the right side?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So you can never really know where they're going to come.
They're brought in randomly, and they're given a slight nudge towards you.
Oh, cool.
That's where they start, but they will arc around looking for you. So. I hated them because I thought it was a cheat. I don't like games that cheat.
Yeah, that does seem. I mean, you're basically being stalked the whole time, and it's highly intentional and not random.
There's only one of them at the beginning, but as the game gets going, lots more are thrown in.
Right.
You occasionally might hear a sound when you're shooting at something in there too. That's. I just limited the number of objects I could track, so sometimes you'll go to hit an object to split it in two, and it'll just pop. Uh-huh. And when it pops, it means I had no objects left to
right, convert. Right, okay.
So this disappears. And the more of those pluses that are out there, the less objects there are. So the faster you can clear a screen.
So what would the hardware want to drop first in the event that there's too many objects on the screen to draw? Like, is there a hierarchy of things that would get eliminated? No.
The only thing I would do is when you went to split a rock, if there wasn't enough objects left, it would pop. And often it would turn an object into a single one of the smaller size rather than two.
Okay.
Sometimes it would just pop it away and it would disappear like a balloon.
Okay. Now Asteroids has a similar limitation, right? Like I think like 38 different objects on screen is all that can handle.
I guess it just disappears as well, right?
Yeah, I don't know for sure. I can get it kind of busy intentionally and. I've never been able to, you know, count. Maybe I could take some video of it, but it doesn't make a distinct sound or anything. I think around 30 or 40, you know, and you have to split a medium asteroid, I think that the rock just disappears altogether.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's and mine will too, but I just added the pop so you would know.
Yeah, that audio cue is fantastic, and now I know what it signifies because I've heard that on my machine and never really put that together as to what it was signifying.
And then there's that bonus wave after you clear all the rock,
right? Which is pretty neat. Like, whose idea was it to come up with that crescendo?
I did that.
That is pretty, I love that pretty sound. Awesome.
It was in Tunnel Hunt used that same. I loved screwing the pokey sounds. If you put two channels just slightly off from each other, they beat, they give that kind of beating sound, and that's what that was. two channels with a slightly different frequency on each of them, and they give that kind of pulsating sound.
Yeah, there's so much bass. Like, the whole cabinet's kind of vibrating.
Yeah, they put a big speaker in some of those, so that was cool, too.
Yeah, I've got one of the uprights, and
it has a big speaker.
Yeah, there's, like, two speakers in the bottom, yeah. I think, a left and a right, and it, I mean, if I'm playing that in the garage, the whole house will know. Yes. I mean, neighborhood will know.
I want good sounds.
Yeah, it's spectacular.
And I also added there that if you hit the other player, they don't lose a life during that time, but you knock them out of that wave. So the real strategy was
to and you get points
shoot
the for last it.
Object and then go shoot the other player immediately.
Right. And some people, I think, exploit that because once you shoot the other player, when they're regenerated, your shields are re-energized, correct?
So that is a way to play longer if you in any of the games where you're playing against each other. So you can either play individually or collaboratively. And collaboratively, it doesn't work. There is a bug where you can do it, but it doesn't always work. But in the individual games, you can play longer by just jumping out in front of the other guy's ship and having him shoot you because you get new shields.
Right. Yeah, totally. That's what I and my daughter do all the time.
The other guy gets points.
Yeah, you get like 500 or something. And
yeah, earn a lot of points. You can get your score up fast that way.
Now, if you're shot right near the end of the wave, though, you don't get to participate in the bonus.
Right. So, no. If you're shot once the bonus starts, you won't come back in. Right. Or if you're shot just before the bonus wave starts, then I can't bring you back in. Right. So that gives the whole bonus wave to one person, which is mean because everything targets one guy. So it becomes a little harder.
Yeah, but that kind of levels the playing field for being a jerk taking the partner out of the bonus round to begin with.
Yeah, you can see a bug. There is a bug in that wave. If you shoot the other guy out after the wave has started. So what happens there, stars are thrown onto the screen at the player. So they're not really targeting. They're just drifting.
Okay.
Okay. And if you shoot them, they go away. But if you let them wrap around the screen, they turn into fuzzballs.
Right, which are the annoying little things that shoot between each other?
Well, no. The white fuzzballs, the little white.
Oh, okay, all right. Not
they turn to those, and those target you.
Okay.
But it's funny, if you shoot a player as one of those is changing, you know, so they know who they're going to target. So they're tossed at a target.
Right.
And when they go around the screen, then they start dynamically tracking that target. And if you shoot the other player after the star has been launched, you'll notice sometimes a fuzzball will sort of orbit an empty spot.
Oh, neat.
Because that's where the player was.
Right, it's lost its target. And It doesn't recalibrate. It's
calibrating at the last known spot, and the thing isn't moving, and it gets confused.
Oh, neat.
So that's why one of them sometimes orbits.
Huh. I have not seen that phenomenon, but now I'm going to try and make it happen.
It does happen. It's weird. Yeah. You'll just see some of them, they orbit nothing. And orbit's not the right word. They kind of seem to be going in a weird path around something that's not there.
Huh. Fascinating.
Okay, so let's see what else is there. We used to call them wave killers. The things you call them jugglers.
Yeah, I guess they're saucers or jugglers, the two ships that shoot between each other and then like if they make additional passes, they get a little further apart, and there's like this death zone between them.
This is what happens when you stall.
Right. Like, there's so many mechanics in here to punish, like,
the goal of that is to wipe out the rocks, right? It goes out and it creates this juggling effect of shots going back and forth between the objects, which was a weird problem because they're moving when they shoot. So when I first wrote that, it would just shoot shots all over the place, right?
It's just like a bullet hell.
Right, because it would shoot it where the other ship was, and that ship isn't there anymore. And it would miss. So literally, the shots are dynamically moved to always hit the other saucer.
So there's like this fusillade of just shots into space.
So you'll notice when you shoot one end, whatever shots are aimed at that saucer will just go wild.
Neat.
They just shoot out. So it is possible if you're sitting in the wrong place and you shoot the end of the saucer that you can get shot because one of the shots will go shoot because they're going pretty fast.
Yeah,
and
they are.
Just wrap around the screen and nail you.
that's neat. And it makes a really unique kind of cool menacing sound while it's doing it.
Yeah, and if you want to really screw with that, put your shields on and bump it so it stops.
What happens then?
Oh, you can leave it. It'll hover on the screen just forever.
Oh, weird.
Like that. So then it's not in your way.
Huh.
And as long as it's out there, I think only one other saucer can come out.
And then it can't pass again, and that zone of death can't get larger.
Yeah, it will slowly drift its way off the screen. But I've done it before where you know, if you bump it too hard, you bump it the other way. So you want to kind of come up with the shields on and give it a little tap to stop it, to nudge it to stop. And it will stop. It will, or almost stop, just going.
That's pretty neat. Itself.
And it just hangs there. So it's not getting wider, and it's not really wiping out the rocks. That was a strategy I saw someone do in the arcade once, and they were really good at it.
Yeah, that's a great exploit, really.
Yeah, I like that one.
Yeah, that's a win for the player. There's so much engineering going on here that's conscious of the lurking strategy and trying to take that out of the equation. It's nice to know that you can get away with some stuff.
As well as Asteroids did, that probably hurt its earnings.
I think Mike and I did an episode on Asteroids that kind of precedes this one, although we have some recorded episodes in between. In the canon of things, we were talking about it last. And we just did a like back of the envelope calculation on the amount of money that Asteroids was purported to make. Right. And there's like, what, over 80,000 cabinets produced, and I think something it's like credited as
86,000 maybe.
Right, yeah. Like the most proliferate arcade game Atari ever did, like 1979.
Ed Logg.
Right.
There's some great stories about me in that game.
I want to hear that too. And Howie Dellman, right? And he do Howie Dellman, the sound? Hardware. Okay. And he programmed like a lot of the noises and the classic shot sounds and
how he did.
It's attributed to him.
I don't know who did that. Sounds.
Okay.
I really don't. Unfortunately, I started doing sounds when the Pokey systems came in. I started the ones that out of the consumer group. I wrote a sound generator routine, and Ed Logg wrote a thing to do sounds on the Atari 800. And so a lot of the sounds were done from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Space Tool benefits from the Pokey and all, but I think that all of Asteroids' sounds are discrete, right? Like all those 11.
So if they're discrete, he did design them. Yeah.
Yeah, all those voices are hardware generated.
Voices?
Well, like sounds channels.
Oh, yeah, there's no real voices.
Right. Yeah.
When you say voices in a hardware game, you know, it's what's the one I think of? Star Trek.
Yeah.
Welcome aboard, Captain.
Yeah, which is pretty awesome. Way to go, Sega.
I love that game.
Me too. Well, tell me about Ed, I guess, and some of your shenanigans in development.
So I used to work late a lot, and Ed Logg was one of these guys who hardly ever worked late. You know, he went home, and so I would go into his lab, and I would play Asteroids until I filled up the high score table all the way with my initials.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd come in and the next morning, and there's ORR is in every initial spot.
You're on the Space Tool table too, aren't you?
Well, I did Space Tool.
Right.
I filled up. So he'd come in every day, and all his name was moved off. So one day I come in, I put ORR in, and it changes it to Ed, you know, EDL, right? Ed Logg. That's very funny. So I started doing OR space.
Nice.
So I filled up the OR space. And then the next day, OR space and ORR wouldn't work. And then, so I used space OR, and then that one didn't work. And then any combination I could possibly think of didn't work. And he'd always put his own name in there. And he jokingly said it was going to go out into the world like that. So I could never put a high score into a machine.
Every permutation of Owen Rubin eliminated. Like every permutation of your initials just totally eliminated. Yeah, I've heard Ed is quite the practical joker.
Ed Rotberg is a practical joker. I don't know if Ed Logg, I guess he does practical jokes, but I wouldn't, you know, he's got one of those dry sense of humors. So I can't tell you if you really, would I say Ed Logg is a practical joker? Not really. No, we did a couple, and Rotberg would do a practical joke. I did one to Rotberg with a lot of help. He got married and he left on a week, maybe 2 weeks. Honeymoon. And we mirror imaged his cube into the cube next to him. And I mean, exactly. We picked everything up and put it, you know, we measured everything and moved it over. And then we got everybody in the office to just pretend like nothing happened.
Nice. Like,
what are you talking about? And I remember one time he was standing there in his office trying to get someone to admit it. And the president of the company walked down and he goes, look what they did to my office. And he looked around. He could see people like hoping he wasn't going to blow it. And he goes, I don't know what you're talking about. It's always, it's your office is where it's always been.
Oh my
and then
God.
We did things like we played. Do you know the TV show The Prisoner?
No.
Okay, so Patrick McGoohan, who used to be Secret Agent Man, quit the show, and everybody wanted to know why he quit. So he created a program called, a TV program called The Prisoner.
Okay.
Okay, and The Prisoner was about a guy who used to be a secret agent who quits, and you can Google it. If you Google The Prisoner, you'll see information about it. He's given a number, number 6. The former government agent who abruptly resigns from his job and has been imprisoned in a beautiful and charming yet bizarre community called The Village.
Okay.
And it's there's like 18 episodes, and it's incredibly weird British sci-fi of a sort. And this I'm trying to see if I can find something here. You'll hear the music in this. Let me see. That's weird. There's no sound in this video. Oh, here we go. So I'm trying to find where this goes. So you see him being eliminated from the, you know, it's like him packing up. And as he's packing up in his house, some guy in a car pulls up, puts some gas in the door, and he falls asleep. And when he wakes up, he's still in his apartment, but his apartment is now in the village. So he falls asleep seeing all the buildings outside his window. And when he wakes up, I'm trying to see if I can find the sound. So he wakes up, he doesn't know where he is, right? Except that he's in his apartment. Everything looks identical.
Right.
Almost the same. He opens his window and he sees the village, right? Not the stuff he normally thought he would see. That's what's happening in this music. That's what's happening in this music.
The village.
Information. Whose side are you on? That would be telling. We want information.
So we would play the music to the prisoner every time Ed would walk into the building. And on his phone, we put the number 6, which is this guy's number.
Right.
Trying to let him know it was a joke, right? Because he's now the prisoner. Because there's a... In this episode, every time he wakes up, you hear this voice go, "Good morning, everyone. It's another beautiful day." Right? So we would do that. And I don't think he realized it. And I don't remember where we were years later. We were talking and we talked about practical jokes. And I said, "Oh, you mean like the time we moved your office?" And he's like, "Aha! I knew it. I knew it."
So that just slipped out in casual conversation.
He still was never sure that we really did that to him then. We had almost convinced him because he didn't move the office back, right?
Right.
But he was convinced. We almost had him convinced that he was crazy, that his office hadn't moved, and he just didn't remember.
Oh, that's epic. You guys let that percolate for years, and then out it comes.
I don't know how long it was when I dropped the bomb on it, and he was like, "Aha! I knew it!" You know. I think all the prisoners are online. It's a very odd show, but they want to know why he resigned. That's the whole idea of this show. But you don't know who you can trust and who's for real and what's going on. And the ending gets the most bizarre ending of a sci-fi series ever.
So it's totally ambiguous and you never really know and you kind of choose your own adventure type thing? Or
just to say it's weird. No spoilers.
Okay.
It was so odd, though, that I actually took a psychology class at UC Berkeley on the show.
They had a class on the series.
Yeah, because you know, and the premise was, okay, you're a secret agent. Your job has been killing people and overturning governments and whatever else secret agents do, and you decide to just quit. You know, wouldn't you kind of feel like everybody was out to get you?
Yeah, the paranoia would be crushing, I would imagine. If you knew what was, quote, really going on, unquote, and couldn't tell anyone, you'd be like a lunatic.
So one of the things was that was this show. That was his brain, what happened to him and going crazy. Why, you know, he was a prisoner of his own mind,
right?
Kind of thing.
Yeah, and just total metaphor.
And then when you see the ending, you realize, okay, nervous breakdown.
All right, you've totally sold it. I'm going to watch it.
It is. It's all on. I'm noticing. I'm looking up here. It's all on YouTube. The Prisoner. It's 1967. So keep in mind, it's early BBC. You know, old Doctor Who quality. You know.
Yeah, this sci-fi, is what
sci-fi like, mystery. I don't even know if I want to call it sci-fi. It has some sci-fi like elements, like the Rover, which is this giant thing that comes out of the water to catch you if you try to escape. And
right.
But it's worth watching. And watch them in order. The other thing to look out for is they screw around with you. Like the name of one episode mm-hmm. is actually a better name for a different episode. So they just mixed up the names, right?
It says that there's a miniseries was remade for AMC back in 2009.
It was terrible.
Oh, okay. All right. Stick with the original.
The remade one is a guy out in the desert and he comes across this village. And it's got the same kind of things.
Oh, but that's not the village.
But not quite. And this one, it's definitely he's on an island, right? You think he's on an island, okay? That's mm-hmm. what they make it look like. He even steals a helicopter in one episode and flies around to see where he is and can't really tell because the helicopter can be controlled, so they don't let him go very far. Huh. But he can't escape. He doesn't. You know, it's not obvious where he is.
This sounds like a treatment from like a Rod Serling mini drama that should have been developed for the Twilight Zone.
It is okay if you like the Twilight Zone. This will fall into place. It's not quite as fast as Twilight Zone kind of stuff. But
right.
I really loved it. I was a real fan of The Prisoner. So that was the joke with Ed, is that we made him a prisoner by moving his office over.
So how did Mr. Rotberg get back at you guys?
I'm trying to think what kind of practical. You'll have to ask him.
That would be a privilege too.
I do remember when we all went to see Star Wars. Gene Lipkin, who was the VP of marketing at that time, came over to engineering to talk to people. And this was the original Star Wars movie. And of course, they had taken us all to the original Star Wars movie, so there was no one in engineering. The building was empty.
Like just in the middle of the day? We're
just in the middle of the day. I mean, he walks over to engineering and there's no one there.
Right.
So,
like that's never happened.
Like that's never happened, right. So right. We come back to work and our phones start to ring. Our phones are all ringing. And we try to answer them. No one can hear us. And Gene Lipkin had come and taken all the mouthpiece microphones out of all the phones and hit them somewhere. And on the whiteboard he wrote, "Hello, hello, can you hear me? The Force is with you."
Right? Nice.
So that guy, it even went up to as high as the executive. So there was fun stuff like that.
That's
so what
cool
else can I tell you about Space Duel, though, since that's where we got digressed off Space Duel. But.
Okay. So the dynamic of single and two player simultaneous, like, was that incorporated from the inception, like from the outright? A game that could play two players?
I don't recall.
It just seems like another way to snare a quarter, to incentivize people, like, you know, drop 50 cents in this thing for the same 3 minutes, you know?
Well, but it's no different than if you play against each other, right? It's still 50 cents.
Congratulations, right? Skippy. You've got mail.
Thank you. sorry, that's my mail sound.
That was epic.
That was a David Letterman sound I caught off the air once, and I just had to keep it. No, you don't really catch another quarter. If you have two players can play any way they want. Mm-hmm. I always have liked the idea of cooperative play.
Okay.
There was an earlier game called Fire Truck a long, long time ago. Howie Delman did that one.
That was a black and white game, right?
Black and white game. It was, you know, you have one guy drive the front, one guy drive the back. It was cooperative. Right. So in the cooperative game where you're tied together, even though you get individual scores, and I'll explain that in a minute, your bonus lives and everything are based on your combined score.
Oh.
And originally it was only going to be the combined score, but I figured, you know, rivalries are good even when you're playing cooperatively.
Right. I mean, every time we attempt a co-op game, it always descends into an every man for himself cutthroat experience. The psychology in the household is just so cutthroat.
Try to drag the other guy into a rock kind of thing?
Yeah, like my wife or my daughter, it's there's a lot of backstabbing that goes on. It's never, you know, we'll try and play Joust or something, and it's never, let's see how far we can go. It's, your points are going to be mine soon. You know, it always devolves into that.
Well, Space Duel is based around the idea that if you play cooperatively, you play longer.
No, I understand, but they...
So in the game where you're tied together, it's to your benefit to watch your player's back.
Right. Yeah, right? The tether kind of forces that dynamic.
Right. You get one hit on either ship, and then the next hit burns the tether out. In the single player game, if you shoot the other player, they come back with new shields, so they can play longer. They play longer, you play longer.
Now,
in fact, in that game, I even insisted on the thing where if you're out of lives, you still come back as a nose cone, right?
Right.
You come back where you can still thrust and fire and get one shot at a time.
Right. Yeah, like you're damaged, right? So yeah.
Well, you're damaged, but I didn't want, if you had one good player and another bad player, the bad player has to sit there and wait forever for the good player to finish, right?
Right.
So I thought, well, let's let the player keep playing. So that's what that idea is about. You get to keep playing. And I've seen players earn enough points as a nose cone to get a new life. And when they die, they come back with a full ship again.
Huh.
So you can resurrect yourself.
So you can pull a Lazarus and come out of the fire.
You can be a phoenix, right? So
right.
Now, so I like the idea of collaborative play. I think you should get more points by playing collaboratively, and you do in both games. Both style games play that way.
Right.
Two player games. Tethered and individual, collaborative play increases score. So I play with friends, you know, I'll go, shoot me. I'll move out in front of them so I can get new shields.
Right, yeah.
There's one other bug you might want to try to, it's dangerous, but you can do it. So, and this is a math bug. So if you're alone in the, it's better when you're alone, because so the other player isn't shooting you. I guess it really doesn't matter, but you don't want to be shot. You hold your shields on if they're low, and you bounce along the white border.
Right.
Because the white border takes a big hunk out of your shields. So think of your shields as a 8-bit number.
Okay.
And they initialize to say 80. And then as you use them, they count down.
Okay.
Okay. If you bounce along that wall, I think it reduces like 7 or 8 from your shields.
Okay, so that's not the best thing to do.
Right. It'll drain your shields very quickly. But if your shields are anything but 8 when the last hit happens, it wraps.
Oh, nice.
I didn't check for it going negative. Okay? So you'll get super bright shields.
Is that negative 255 issue?
Yeah, around F8.
Right.
And now you have twice the shields you had before.
And they're searing into your retinas because
they're so very bright. You can tell they're incredibly bright because their brightness is based on their upper byte of data. So they're at F instead of 8. So they're very bright. And I've seen people use that. You know, they learned they could do that and get these super shields. So they would shoot out the other guy. They would kill everything but one object in the maze. Mm-hmm. Because you have to bounce along the edge, and you don't want that. And sometimes when you're doing that other object sneaks around the edge and hits you. But they'll bounce around the edge, and all of a sudden the shields will come on really bright, and they just go shoot the last object. Now they got super shields for the next wave.
That's amazingly digging down to the metal there.
What sucks, of course, if you have super shields and the other player hits you, when you come back with a regular shield.
Yeah, it resets, right?
So if you want to play cutthroat, when you see someone do that, the first thing you want to do is shoot them.
That's good to know. I've never, now that I understand a bit more how that works, I think we'll probably be able to perfect it. But I'm not sure that we've ever triggered that.
Yeah. Well, most people don't bounce along the edge, right?
Yeah, we don't. We kind of stay in the center and drift around in like a radius of a few inches and shoot stuff.
I do it on the bottom because it seems to be the easiest for me. You point down at a slight angle and thrust and just go, and it just bounces along the bottom edge.
Mm-hmm.
And you do that until you either blow up because the shield number happened to be an even multiple of 8.
Okay.
There is, you know, an 8 out of, what is that, 1 out of 8 chance? Is that right? So that it might be a multiple of 8. I guess it's, 2 out of 16, right? So 1 out of 8. Okay. Yeah. Or your shields will come on really bright, in which case then you end the wave.
Nice.
The other thing I've done, though, is that, you know, that sound gets higher and higher, and you have to listen to the sound, because I've seen people do this, but they don't do it soon enough, and then the wave ends while they're bouncing along the wave, and of course, the force field disappears, and they bounce out the other side with real weak shields.
Nice.
So it can screw you as well, you know.
Now, there is a point, I guess, where the register of that increasing, like, crescendo noise ceases, right? And the wave will suddenly end?
That's right.
Okay, because we never let that actually happen. So we
the
just
wave, will, end up, the wave will end on its own after, I forget, n seconds. It's so many seconds, and then it just stops.
Okay. Is it pretty sudden? Because I listen to that tone, stops. But I'm always fearful, you know, and it puts this great kind of pressure on you. And you feel the anxiety of the thing closing. And
yeah, it's one of the few times that you can have an object appear on top of you. So there's a lot of software in there that if you die,
mm-hmm.
Okay, the reason it sometimes takes a long time to come back in is I look for an empty space where no rocks are going to fly through it.
Yeah, it's kind of the same problem Asteroids has, right? Like, right. You get wiped out and everything's floating in the center. You have to, I guess, if there's
Asteroids
some...
Asteroids comes in the center always, so it waits even longer. I look for a space.
Okay.
So the spots are not always the same. Which is why, so the ship blinks when it comes in.
Right.
It's vulnerable while it's blinking. I mean, it's invulnerable while it's blinking.
Okay.
So if it blinks on top of an object, that object will just blow up.
Okay. And that's
last for about 3 seconds. It was also blinking to try to get your attention to where it was coming in.
Right. That's handy, because if you can't rely on exactly where it's going to reappear when you emerge, then, right. So, and that kind of speeds the process up artificially a little bit too, right? Like, you don't have to wait for Asteroids to clear out.
No, so what'll happen is if you'll notice that if you both die at the same time, the rocks will disappear off the edge of the screen. They'll stop. And then you'll both be brought back in and the rocks will continue again.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I will, if I'm waiting, like, especially if you're playing in the... you'll see it especially in the two-player tied together mode. Watch the rocks. They go off the screen. They stop. They disappear. And then they're actually basically held on the edge where they were. You appear, then they're let go. So you'll notice while it's waiting that the screen starts getting less and less crowded. Usually you don't get to see it for very much, because eventually I find a place to bring you back in. But it's possible for that to happen.
Are there any, like... Easter eggs or hidden messages or inside jokes buried, I guess, in the heart of the code?
I don't think so. I don't think I did any kind of Easter eggs in that game.
Was that a popular thing for as popular as the internet would have you believe?
We usually got caught.
Right. Because I guess management wasn't too friendly about wasting all that register space on narcissistic pursuits.
Oh, they didn't care about. I don't think they cared about that. They were more about bugs.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, like when I did Major Havoc, the place where the story is was actually a credit screen. That scrolling story was credits. I put everybody's credits in there. Everybody who worked on it, and
is like the first time that's ever happened, right?
Well, no one had done it yet, and I decided I was going to try to do it. And when the management saw it, they said, "Nope, not going to happen." So I had a story all along. I went and rewrote it. And I put a story in there, and they said the story was too long, so it got shortened to the shorter version of that story.
Now, didn't, like, Mike Halley put in the stars and, like, Star Wars, ESB, can't you draw people's initials?
On the side of the Death Star, if you turn the brightness up, mm-hmm. you'll see the initials on the side of the Death Star.
Okay.
And, you know, usually... All the high score tables had our initials in it.
Right.
Someone tried to write their names vertically once. And I think that got caught too. And when we were doing trying to remember the driving game. I did this driving game called F1.
Sebring, okay.
It had billboards. And after a certain speed, the billboards would change to credits.
Oh, neat.
So if you slammed on the brakes, you could see one. And, of course, the marketing guy, Gene Lipkin, gets in and he's playing it, and he slams on his brakes and gets one of the billboards to stop right in front of his face.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, "What's this?" I said, "Oh, it must be a glitch." You know, they were so afraid that if we put our names in there, that if we did a good game, that the competing companies would try to steal us.
Yeah, that's what everyone seems to proliferate, that same feeling that management was worried about locking down the talent and obfuscating you guys from being devoured by headhunters and
competitors.
I mean, so many people like quit in disgust or slipped out the back door and stuff.
The real quit in disgust didn't happen until is it Manny Girard? Ray Kassar.
The sock king, right?
Yeah, the towel king. Yeah, whatever. Yeah. He the people in the consumer group started demanding credits on the box. So they were like a movie. And we wanted him in CoinOp as well. And he made this, you know, really terrible comment about how video game designers were like ribbon clerks in a store, and he could get all the ones he wanted.
Right.
Right. And there was a big exodus. You know, Imagic came out of that exodus. Activision came out of that exodus. Probably a few other little game companies came out of that. And these guys just said, "Screw you, we're leaving."
Yeah, I mean, when you add up what their code was generating and contrast that with what they were being paid, I can understand why they did it.
Well, that'd be like telling a guy who wrote a movie, we can't give you a screen credit because we don't want someone to steal you. You know, we were in the entertainment industry. We felt like we should have our names on things.
Right. Or that you're no more important than the dolly grip over there who's, you know, moving crap around on the set. Like,
right.
Of course there's a hierarchy. That's why you're an executive and I'm not.
I guess we were more important, no more important than the ribbon clerks, as he put it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was kind of sad. It really was that, we couldn't have our names in the game. And I think it finally changed, but I can't remember when they changed that. Not long after I left, the System One games started having credits in them.
So that was kind of the impetus, though, for Major Havoc, for like putting all those names up there. It was just you were going to get it all in one shot.
I had already written a background story. There was a whole background story to Major Havoc. You know, who he was, why he was doing this. I remember one magazine guy writing, "Finally, someone explains why I get more than one life."
No, yeah. Did you like craft this fan fiction about it, like intentionally?
Oh yeah. Okay. Oh yeah. There is a story. You've read the story, right?
No, sir.
So if you just start up the emulator and let the attract run.
Okay.
And there's a story about Major Havoc. It was a lot longer than the one that's in there now. They made me shorten it.
Okay.
But I mean, there was a whole, you know, it's very Battlestar Galactica-ish. Because that was the show that I think I was watching a lot of at the time, the original one. You know, it's the Vaxians, which was basically a play on Vax computers from Digital Equipment Corporation.
Right. Isn't that what you guys had at the office where you had to punch all your code in?
Yep. So the evil Vaxian Empire overran the galaxy, enslaved your people, and all these spaceships patrolled, you know, run by robots. You know, patrol the galaxy trying to wipe mankind out. And so the scientists who escaped cloned this guy Major Havoc, because, you know, you obviously don't want to, it came out of the long story, but it came out of the short story. You don't want your best Major out there to die. So they cloned him. They cloned Major Havoc, and they send his clone out through a wormhole from where they're hiding. They're hiding in a wormhole in space.
Okay.
Somewhere, and they send these guys out to go kill off these space stations and try to free the people. These people.
So that is how you are, in fact, not going to die in one shot.
Right. So you're a clone. So what happens is when you know, in the original story arc, when you jump through the wormhole, they know where they send you. They're in contact with you, so they know what you're doing. And if you die, they immediately fire another clone out right to the same place, and he takes over where you left off.
Right. Makes sense.
Right. So if you've killed off all the space patrols around that space station, then they stay killed off. If you've killed off a couple of robots inside the space station, then they stay killed off.
So if you're a clone, why can't you be infinitely replicated?
Well,
why do you have a finite number of lives to begin with?
Clones are expensive.
Okay. Damn right they are.
In fact, if you look at the attract mode, it'll say, you know, it's 3 clones for a quarter, you know.
Okay.
Clones.
Okay.
And, you know, it's a problem of, you know, in the original long story, they're hiding, so they don't have a lot of material. They can only make so many clones, right?
Right.
They take time, right? So they're not instantaneous, right? There's no facility to clone the people out where they are. You have to clone them, you know, in your secret base station.
Right, and then export them to somewhere where they can be utilized.
So in the obnoxious things on games, if you put that game in free play, normally it'll say, at the end of the instructions, it'll say, get 3 clones for a quarter. You may even earn a bonus clone from time
right.
to time.
Right, very tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, but if you put it in free play, it said, clones are free, we're giving them away.
Nice. Which is sadly something that probably no one back in the day ever got a chance to see, right? Yeah.
That has a lot of weird little hidden messages, some of which were supposed to have been taken out that never got taken out. That caused, actually, Atari got sued because of one of the messages I left in.
Well,
he never finished the game, okay? It ran a long time.
I heard that you had actually, like,
endings I designed an end wave on paper, but I never got to implement it. So the end wave was you eventually reach the homeworld of Maynard. Now, if you're at all a digital equipment, if you know anything about Digital Equipment Corporation, they were located in Maynard, Massachusetts.
Right.
So the homeworld of the Vaccine Empire was Maynard.
It was where they were assembled.
Yeah, okay. So Maynard was the homeworld. Okay. And you would go there, and there was you would land, go down an elevator into the inside of the planet, where you would find this huge factory where they were manufacturing robots and ships. And in there were, you know, 4 reactors, not just one. And you had to basically go kill off, you know, set off all those reactors that would blow up the planet. And that would be the end of the game.
Yeah.
And we never got that, you know, return to Vax.
Okay, this is triggering my memory now. Like, I think I understand where this is going, because I know I've read something somewhere where extremely astute player, you know, goes over, like, the last playable level over and over and over again, and a message is, like, continue on to the end.
Well, no, so there's a message. There's a tactical screen that shows up that I put just silly messages in until I really decided what I wanted in there. And one of the messages says, keep playing, the homeworld is near.
But it doesn't really...
It's never near. And I was long gone out of Atari, and I remember I think Dan Van Eldren called me, and he said, Owen, does the word keep playing, your homeworld is near mean something to you? And I said, yeah, it does. He goes, is that really in the game? I said, it probably still is, yeah. And he says, well, we're getting sued by some youngster who spent, you know, double thousands of dollars, multi-thousands of dollars, trying to find the homeworld. Where the hell's the homeworld? And I said, well, you could be obnoxious and tell him he has to turn left at, like, level 42.
Right, like a Douglas Adams reference, level 42.
Yeah, he missed a turn, right? So,
right.
And he says, no, we don't want to lie because he's got an attorney, so...
Oh my God! If you'd sunk $5,000 in that game and retained a lawyer, why didn't you buy an upright, fool?
Well, so they gave him one.
Of course they did.
And they refunded some of his money, you know.
Oh my!
And I had to apologize to him that we never got the homeworld done.
You had to publicly apologize to some
brat? No, I called him on the phone and said, you know, it was a joke message, you know. Much like garbage ejected.
Was he like a total impetuous tool, or was
he? No, he was actually very nice about it.
Oh, okay.
Because I really wanted to find a homeworld. Was there going to be one? I said there was going to be one.
Yeah, that's why you sued us, jerk.
We just never got to do it, you know. He was thinking that, you know, that it was a, you know, their comment was, and within somewhat reason, correct, that we were misleading people to keep playing because they would get to an end game. And, of course, the picture he sent us, no one had ever gotten that far.
Right, and anyone who knew anything about arcade culture should understand implicitly that most of these games don't end. They just endlessly repeat until you're crushed out of existence.
If the game says it does, sort of owe it to the player to do with the game. I mean,
poetic license, artistic interpretation.
I don't know, if I'd taken the message out, nothing would have happened, right? You know, it's right. Like, So it's my own fault for leaving that message in. Yeah. You know, that's like, there's a garbage ejected message that shows up. That's what it says, garbage ejected. And I remember when I did that screen, I said, what should I put up there? And one of the guys I was working with goes, oh, put some kind of garbage message up there.
So you took it literally.
They put the word garbage ejected.
Nice. And
you would not believe. So when you if you press the any button while you're in that screen waiting, it puts up the word garbage. It flashes the word garbage ejected. People ask me all the time, what does that mean?
Right. What's the secret meaning of garbage ejected?
There was no secret meaning whatsoever. It was me being obnoxious.
It's so ambiguous. It's brilliant. I can understand how like a whole probably myth evolved from, you know, your just arbitrary message there.
Come on. I wanted to say, oh, you know, it's a computer science thing where you have all this extra memory that's left over from the game playing and that ejects it out of, you know, the core so that the machine can run better, you know.
Did anyone sue Atari because the machine didn't actually eject garbage?
No.
Okay. What do you consider your magnum opus, Owen?
What, my best game?
Yeah.
Well, it's obviously Major Havoc.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I mean, there sounds like there's a lot of love there.
There is a lot of love there. I have worked on it for almost a year, and it kept growing. And then Mark Cerny, who was fairly new at Atari at the time, we got him to join. And so the last four waves in that game, he did. And I can't get through them. They're still too hard.
Was he like 17 at the time?
18.
So he had recruited right out of high school.
He had done, we saw him in an arcade. He was kicking the shit out of our games. Like, you want a job, you know? And he's hell yes. So he came and he did it. He did a sliding tile duck game first, which I loved, but other people didn't like it.
What was that called?
I think it was called Quack, but I don't remember.
That was Quack? Okay. Interesting.
There was another Quack, but that game was, you know, each tile had a piece of river on it. One, you know, some pieces ran top to bottom, some pieces ran left to right, some people's pieces had curves, some had Ys in them. And the ducks would come on the screen in the upper left-hand corner onto a tile, and there was an empty spot, and you had to slide the tile around to get all the tiles around to get all the ducks off the bottom right. And I said what I wanted to change it to is, instead of sliding a tile, you tap a tile and it goes in that hole. Make it much easier, because it became really impossible to move tiles fast enough. And if a duck that was swimming down the river fell off into a hole or hit a tile that didn't fit, you would just see this little feather float down the screen. Was very funny. And then he joined me to finish up Major Havoc. So he did we had a different space wave that took too long in the game. It was way too long. And we took that out and he did the flying ducks, the flying fish.
Okay.
There was a Star Castle wave in the original game, where a space station came out with a force field around it.
Like a rotating
Rotating force field, yeah, blow a hole in it, and then there was four guns on the space station, and you had to shoot out the guns. And it took out that level alone, it took a minute and a half to 2 minutes to solve. Huh. So much for a 90-second game.
No kidding, right?
So the fourth space wave in Major Havoc still has the ship. You'll notice it has a shield around it, and it has guns on the side of the space station. And it bounces around just like it bounced around. But we basically, and then those pink lines that fall, every time you hit a shield, that's what would fall, right? So it could kill you. The shield you knocked down would fly at you and it could kill you. So you had to be careful. So
unlike Star Castle.
Star Castle, they just disappeared, right?
Yeah, they just disappeared.
But it was too hard. It was too long. So I just made it another, you know, space attack game. With Cylon Raiders, which is, if you look closely, that's what they are.
Yeah, totally.
And pink. They actually have patterns, if you watch. They actually fly patterns. The pattern where there's one green and two yellow in the front, if you shoot the green first, the two yellow ones will dive bomb you.
I mean, this game is like your Sergeant Pepper.
It was basically like what all the stuff could I throw in there.
Right.
Including a breakout game.
There's a breakout game?
Yeah. You have obviously not played a lot of Major Havoc.
I have never played Major Havoc.
The main version is awful, but you should play it. So when you first start up, the ship flies out the wormhole, basically. Mm-hmm. You are put into a screen that shows you what's coming up next. And in the bottom right-hand corner of it is a small breakout game. So if you push a button, which causes the garbage ejected message to appear, it also launches the ball in the breakout game, and the roller moves the paddle.
Oh, fantastic.
And you get about 12 seconds to play breakout for a while. And if you take out all the bricks, you get an extra life. It's hard. You have to survive about four waves. You have to survive four waves and play breakout well in order to get that finished. But it's doable.
But that little extra incentive is there. Like, it's there's a depth here that doesn't exist in other games, clearly.
So Major Havoc was the first game to do idle animations.
Yeah, I have seen where Havoc will tap his foot in disgust, I guess, if you haven't moved him.
Haven't moved, or he'll lean against a wall.
Is the game on a clock?
Yes.
Okay, so you actually
you're on a clock when you're in the maze.
Okay.
Nowhere else. So when you go in the maze, you're in a spacesuit, you know, and your oxygen's running down. That's the clock.
Okay.
And you start a second clock when you touch the reactor. Its countdown to critical starts.
Right, then you have to get the hell out before you're blown apart.
There are little Pac-Man-like oxygen dots you can pick up to increase your time.
And there's a weird gravity in play, right? Like, you're jumping and all is kind of critical to be able to navigate vertically.
So it occurred to me, if you're in a space station without gravity, you could jump as long as you were standing on the ground.
Pretty much.
But you can't jump when you're not on the ground.
Yeah, there's nothing to push off of. Right?
So the button works that way. If you press the button when you're on the ground, you will jump. Now, there is a little bit of gravity, so you do come back down.
Right.
But if you let go of the button, as long as you hold the button, you continue to go up.
Okay.
That's the thing I did. Until you either hit your head on something or you go as high as you want, then you let go, and it's like turning off thrusters. You kind of continue upward a little bit and then arc back down.
Okay, so eventually, like, the pull will balance out the inertia, and you'll start to fall again.
Start coming down. Okay. And if you press the button again, nothing happens.
Right.
Unless you're on a platform.
Okay.
So it takes a little while. It takes a bit to get used to.
Did Mark help? Was he like autonomous when he came on to finish like those last waves, or did you guys work collaboratively?
He collaborated in a lot of stuff. He did a lot of tuning, a lot of changing. He added this weird rail gun that was very cool. It's that it violated my rules on what I wanted the maze, but it made sense given you how far up in the game you were. That my original thought was, if you destroyed something in the game, it stayed destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there is no way to destroy the rail gun shots without either using up your shield or dying. But since the rail gun is always shooting, those shots always come back. And there's no way to run into the railgun and destroy it. So it's always there.
It's just like this omnipotent foe.
It kills you the same way. It kills you like a firewall, like the firewalls do. They stay as well, right? So it just doesn't go away. But it's a cool process. His waves are doable but hard. I've made it through once, but
once.
You really need to play his last four waves. So you can't warp forward any further than wave 12. And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 are his waves.
Oh, so this game has a skill step feature too, where you can start by a warp?
There are three warp codes that will jump you past certain waves.
Are they well documented?
I'm sure they're all over the web.
Okay.
2, 3, 4, 6, 8, 24, 3, 14, 3, 15. So 2, 3, and 4, 6, we just made up. 8, 24 is Mark Cerny's birthday, and 3, 15 is my birthday.
Nice.
Okay. And then there is an alternate set of ROMs out there that this guy named Jeff Askey did called Return to Vax, and he added three or four more levels, and he has a sparkle warp, and I don't remember the sparkle warp, or maybe it's a purple warp. He added a new warp level. To jump you into like levels 14 or something.
Did he create an ending?
No, he was going to, but so he reverse engineered the ROMs. He found out who I was. He called me and asked me a few questions. Now I I filled the ROMs pretty full. And he must have compressed stuff and rewritten some code in order to add four more waves to the game and a new warp. I mean, it's pretty impressive that he was able to do that in the existing game. So my Major Havoc, my prototype Major Havoc has those ROMs in it.
Wow. Oh, so you have the actual hardware prototype?
Yes. Well, actually, at the moment, I don't have it. I lent it to someone so they can make a copy of the cabinet.
Oh, neat. You have a space duel, right?
I have a cocktail table space duel.
Yeah, much harder to find nowadays.
Harder to find, and you can't move them. They weigh 600 pounds. They are the heaviest things in the world. It's just it's impossible to move them. I don't know why they're so heavy, but they are.
Who's bright idea? Sorry.
Well, I guess they're afraid of people standing on them. So they had to be built very, very strong.
I would never cross my mind to crawl up on top of a cocktail, but I mean, I guess it's happened.
People get up on tables and bars all the time, right? So
yeah, but
worst case scenario, you don't want someone stepping up there and having the thing fall over.
Yeah, I can understand that. I was raised in a manner that was respectful of people's furniture, and
I tend to agree with you. But I'm just saying, when you design, you know, we used to laugh that, you know, there's consumer specs, there's military specs, and then there's arcade specs.
Nice.
Okay, because you know, consumer specs, you have it at home, they're going to break eventually.
Right.
Military specs, they have to survive very rough battlefield conditions, okay?
Planned obsolescence at home, right?
But at least the guys in the military know that if something works, they stop pulling. Something doesn't work, they stop pulling on it, okay?
Right.
Then there's arcade specs that if the steering wheel stops working, the kid will pull on it to the point of knocking the cabinet over on himself.
Right.
Or he'll beat on it, or he'll hit on it.
Right, or snack machine or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean... So it has to be designed to, you know, so if you have a cocktail table game and it screws up, someone's going to jump up on top of it. So it has to be strong enough to survive idiots.
Yeah, it's a whole new perspective, Owen, but you've got to be right. I've never even thought about it that way. I mean, sure, we've all seen people beating on upright equipment, but
yeah,
I guess I just haven't seen that many cocktails for that kind of rationale to come into the equation. And I've got a Warlords, but I would never imagine sitting on it or crawling on it or letting anyone even lean on the damn thing.
It makes me laugh when I think about it. It really does. Because people will do that crap. People do stupid stuff. I don't know. I don't get it. I mean, there's stories of people pulling so hard on the steering wheel that they knock the game over on themselves.
Yeah, we've all heard the urban legend about the kid who was killed playing Pole Position 2 a little too energetically, but
I don't know if it's true or not either, right?
So yeah, or the guys that, you know, had a heart attack playing Berserk, you know, I don't know. I tend to
cut his fingers because he spun the steering wheel on a sprint and then went to reach for the steering wheel and got his hand caught on the spokes.
Yeah, I could see how that would mangle you. Yeah, but you know. Dying? Probably not.
I don't know, if you dumped a game on top of yourself, they're pretty heavy.
Yeah, I mean, I guess a Firefox or something would flatten you pretty good.
But, you know, no one's done that with a pinball machine, have they?
Nah. I don't think so. I mean, Space Duel's pretty heavy, the upright itself. That would probably kill you. Whose idea was it to... Now, my Space Duel has a 6100 in it. And I've heard that some of the early ones don't have the Wells Gardner, but instead they have the Amplifone. Although I've never seen an Amplifone in one.
They were changed, and I don't know. I know in Major Havoc it was a whole new monitor because it had to be faster.
Right.
And the guy who picked my monitor up, looked at me and my computer game up, and went, "You have the old monitor in here. No wonder your game doesn't play very well." I what? You know, so
yeah,
newer ones were faster and had a little more protection.
Okay. I've only ever seen the 61s, so I've got a couple of vectors that are color, like a Gravatar and a Tempest and the Space Duel, and they're all the 61s. I've never seen an Amplifone.
I think an Amplifone is what I might have in mind, so I can't remember.
Yeah, that would be definitely faster hardware than the 61 from what I know.
Well, so Major Havoc's vector generator was much faster too. It could draw a lot more objects, which is why when they did the Tempest conversion for Major Havoc, it didn't look as good because the hardware wasn't as fast.
What is it about Tempest that staggers those monitors so bad? Like, Major Havoc will run pretty well, right? And Space Duel, I've never had any trouble with mine. It runs like a top, and I never even open the back of the damn thing. But Tempest is real finicky.
So, I don't know about... Since Tempest got the first hardware, it probably doesn't have as much of the protection stuff in it. So, the virtual drawing space, think of it as nine squares where the monitor's in the middle.
Uh-huh.
So you can virtually draw on the other ones and then scroll into them. But you shouldn't be drawing back there because that's literally trying to bend the beam to the back of the monitor.
Right.
Major Havoc has some software to prevent that. I work very hard on clipping, you know, things that go off the edge of the monitor. Star Wars, on the other hand, does not. I'm surprised Star Wars isn't blowing up monitors left and right. In fact, where you can see Star Wars go nuts is when they blow up the Death Star and that ring.
Yeah, the giant circles that...
That circle passes the edge of the screen and the whole monitor kind of glows. Mm-hmm. That's just asking to blow the damn monitor up.
Yikes. So I guess you could take like an artificial stance on that and just shrink the pots down, I guess, to draw the picture a little smaller and cheat in from the sides of the screen.
Still deflecting. It's all about the deflection, right? Mm-hmm. So there's big current transistors that are sending current into coils to deflect the beam to where you want it to draw. And the further off the edge of the screen you go, the more current you're sending through those coils.
Right.
Through that transistor. So
the TO3s on the frame, I guess?
Yeah, eventually they pop. They get too much current and off they go.
Wow.
So the early games, we didn't even know about that. So... but in later games, you know, Space Duel had some protection against drawing off the edge of the screen. I would delete objects pretty fast.
Okay, so that was a known constraint, and the engineering was done to facilitate, like, a more reliable game?
Sadly, it was a very well-known state.
Okay. The poor Dave Toyer took a lot of crap, I guess, for Tempest?
Tempest was a good game. It had a bug left in it. A screen protection bug, so you couldn't remove the name Atari, and then just before it went out, he moved the name Atari, and it messed up his protection, which is why you've heard these stories of, you know, if you get certain scores, the game will go nuts and put 97 credits into it.
Yeah, that's I've read that extensively because I have an upright Tempest that's been rebuilt and. Knock on wood, is being fine now, but I've never been adept at getting the score. I know you have to be within a certain number of thousands, and then I guess the last digit of the score, 1, 2, 9, or 7.
It's silly. I don't understand it. I think he made it 2. The goal was that if we thought the game was a ripoff, because people were ripping off our games, especially out of the country, that we were just going to throw free credits into the game all the time.
Okay, so that was intentional to thwart the copycats.
Exactly. So what happened is his code looked for the word Atari on the screen, and if it didn't find it, it went ahead and did this weirdness to, you know, random weirdness based on score and stuff, but he made the criterion too strict. Because what happened is it didn't find the word Atari on the screen because he moved it.
Right.
You know, he's trying to clean up the screen and he moved it, and he completely forgot that he had done that. My game Tunnel Hunt had a lot of stuff like that, and we weren't allowed to document it because they didn't want anybody to know about it. You know, they didn't want me to fix it for anybody. I remember when we sold Tunnel Hunt to Centauri, they asked if I could remove the Atari logo and the name Atari, and I said, no, I can't.
Right, that's a kind of
protection, and I don't know how to get it out of there. And in that game, it's really weird. It turns out. Space AT is a JSR instruction in that processor to right to the middle of the memory map where the code was.
Uh-huh.
So what I did is I jumped to the screen where the space Atari name was. So if it was removed, the game would just crash.
Right.
So actually, I did more. I set decimal mode on the processor, so everything ran in BCD.
Okay.
I jumped to the screen that did a JSR to a location. And if that location was correct, it would clear decimal mode and then return and then jump back to the place in the ROM where the code should continue.
Okay. So it's its own hardware check, I guess, for authenticity.
I guess I JSR'd to the screen and I JSR'd to the code check. Yeah, because 20, let's see, was it AT? So 20A is 40 and T is 54. So it was a JSR to 5440 in the ROM. So at 5440, you know, I jumped around that code so I could keep that space free, was a clear decimal mode, pop the stack of one address, and then do an RTS. And that would cause it to return back to the normal game and keep running. So if the name Atari was removed from the screen...
Right, just Crash City.
It would just... The game would do some really weird shit. All right, well, I gotta call it here for it, because I'm... But I'd love to continue this at a later time. If you want to talk more, reach out to me and find me.
Okay, will do. I'll process this, and I want to thank you for your generosity and for spending time with me. It's fantastic to learn these things. It's a wealth of knowledge, and I'm sure that the listeners we have will really appreciate being able to hear this stuff from the source and not just some cut and paste crap from Wikipedia, you know?
If they want to email you with questions, or they can email me at, I can't remember what it is. If you go to lrubin.com, I have a very old website up there, and there is a link that still sends me email.
Okay.
And I have stories there too. Yes, it's a very old website. It still uses frames. I've never taken the time to update it.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
But it's an old site. I update the data occasionally. Right. But there's a lot of stories about my games and stuff up there, and you can find the link to me. I think it's owen@orubin.com, something like that. That will get to me, and I'm happy to answer questions.